From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The aged care crisis in Victoria is the latest focus of the COVID pandemic in Australia. More than 800 residents and staff in dozens of nursing homes across Melbourne and the Mitchell Shire have tested positive, and there have been multiple deaths of residents. The federal government funds and regulates aged care, while the health system is a state responsibility. And we've seen obvious tensions in recent days between the Morrison government and Daniel Andrews' administration in Victoria, as they've battled to manage the situation. Patricia Sparrow is CEO of Aged and Community Services Australia, a peak body which covers not-for-profit members that provide residential care for some 450,000 older people throughout the nation. Ms. Sparrow has also previously worked within government as a ministerial advisor on aged care to coalition ministers, so she's seen aged care policy from inside as well as from the outside. Patricia Sparrow joins us today. Patricia Sparrow, could the Victorian aged care crisis have been avoided?
I think what we're seeing is really an impact of community transmission. And so to the extent that we could stop community transmission, we might have been able to stop the widespread outbreaks that we now see in aged care. And I think we knew that as the restrictions were lifting, that aged care was particularly vulnerable. So the most effective way to stop outbreaks is to stop community transmission.
But given that we knew the vulnerability of this sector and it was much talked about by officials, why were many of these facilities apparently unprepared?
I don't know if they were really unprepared as a whole. I think most facilities had prepared well. They have pandemic plans, they'd looked at their PPE, they'd looked at their staffing. I think what we've seen in Victoria is at such a scale that it's been a big impact, and that's made it really difficult because there are things now like workforce shortages, the number of people who are being infected has made it really difficult for them to respond as well as what they would want to themselves.
One point that's been made by the federal government in particular is that when there's been an outbreak, the whole workforce at that facility has been sent home, and that's made it difficult to get other staff. But there was obviously never going to be any alternative but to send everyone home, was there? So shouldn't there have been plans to have a secondary workforce available for a facility?
So the workforce challenge is the major one that we're really experiencing. And I guess the plan that was in place was that there is a surge workforce that the Commonwealth government had provided that was seen to be where there was an outbreak, the surge workforce would come in. And unfortunately, it is a result of the scale of what we're seeing in Victoria, which means that even the surge workforce is under stress. It's important to note too, Michelle, that you know, the workforce in aged care was already under stress before COVID. So what we're seeing is a system that was already under stress. We know that we needed more workers in aged care before COVID broke. And so now we're seeing the fact that was an issue before COVID play out in a terrible way through what's an awful time. But the surge workforce itself that was seen as the secondary measure is now under stress itself.
So to what extent did that surge workforce operate effectively? Obviously not completely, but did it help the situation? And how many people were involved in that?
Look, it certainly helped the situation, and the surge workforce was used in New South Wales where there were outbreaks. And what providers have told me is when the surge workforce came in, it worked really well. So I think and in terms of the numbers of people, I couldn't tell you the exact numbers of people, but I know it was a significant number of people that you need to staff and to care for people when there is an outbreak. So it has worked well, but again, the scale of what we're seeing in Victoria is making it difficult for all of our normal workforce avenues plus the surge workforce to meet. And that's really why the Victorian Response Centre has been set up and why some of the moves over the last couple of days freeing up private hospital staff who would have been involved in elective surgery to help have been necessary.
That response workforce is federal and state, and it coordinates operations, right? But it's only very few people.
The Victorian Response Centre is federal and state. The surge workforce was something that the Commonwealth introduced, and they're using services like Aspen and Mabel to actually bring in that extra capacity.
Just on this question of workers in homes in normal situations, one of the problems identified in this extraordinary situation is that these people are low paid, they're often casual, they're working across facilities, and they have no, or haven't had until very recent days, any special financial provision if they don't get shifts. Do you think that's been a problem in the difficulties that we've seen?
Well, undoubtedly, and you know, as I said, workforce has been an issue in aged care for quite some time. We've needed more workers, haven't always had the money to pay for more workers, but we need more workers generally, and there's no doubt that COVID is exposing some of the issues that were already in the system. We think it's about 30% of all staff in residential aged care that have shifts in other facilities, and you know, the principle that's been brought in now around one worker, one site, which is absolutely critical and sensible, but it's very difficult and will have an even bigger impact on the workforce and on providers being able to get the staff they need.
We've seen the blame game break out over the last couple of days in terms of where the blame for what's still happening in Victoria should lie. What do you think?
Look, I'm sort of less interested in the blame game than actually sorting out what needs to happen now so that those people that we're caring for are getting the support that they need and that we stop this from happening elsewhere. I think we've all got a role to play, the Commonwealth, the state, and the federal government. One of the biggest issues for us, though, is the interface between aged care and the health system. So one of the things that we've been calling for, that our position is, that those people who test positive, particularly the first cases, should be transferred to hospital. We think that gives the individual the best chance of survival and the best care and support that they can get, while enabling us in the facility to make sure that we're protecting, you know, what could be another 100 residents. I guess the gap between that interface between aged care and health is laid bare through this as well. That's something that's still not happening in Victoria. It's happening on a case-by-case basis. In South Australia, they have a policy now of transferring people to hospital when they're diagnosed as positive, and we think that's something that should be occurring across the board. And they, you know, you could use subacute or private hospitals, but I think the thing is that separation and giving the facility a chance to stop the spread or prepare and work with the public health unit to be better set up to manage it if there is going to be an outbreak is really important. The thing about aged care is we're not hospitals. We're not staffed like hospitals. We're not funded like hospitals. And while we provide clinical services to older people and we manage things like the flu and gastro that have got vaccinations and known treatments, you know, COVID is a different beast altogether. And once it's in a facility, it's really difficult. So I think it's important to acknowledge that while aged care providers are doing everything that they can, we are not staffed or funded like hospitals, and we can't provide the disease containment and the care that people need once we're in this situation that Victoria is in.
Nevertheless, some people argue, and I think it was the practice in New South Wales, that you have hospital in the home. In other words, that some patients won't want to move, would be worse off if they moved, and if they're at the end of their life, they would prefer, and their families would prefer them to stay where they are. You just reject that approach?
I don't reject it. I understand what people are saying, and I think it's really difficult, you know, but we are in a pandemic and we're not set up to operate like a hospital. I think, you know, one of the issues that providers have really had through this is how do we make sure that we look after an individual's rights and, you know, their wishes and rights, as well as supporting, as I said, it might be another 100 residents. That issue about individual and collective rights and responsibilities has been a difficult thing right throughout the pandemic. It's heartbreaking to think that someone may not be able to have their have their wish to stay in the facility. But, you know, we've got to take a responsibility across all of that. And I do think hospital in the home is a possibility. And it's why our policy isn't that everybody has to go to hospital, but it is that the first cases do. And why that's important is because it hopefully helps us to stop the spread and gets the person the best treatment. But it also allows us critical time to set up and to work with the public health unit so that we can then provide hospital in the home. But I think that, you know, if we don't have that time to set up and there is a risk that the spread continues to other people, that's what we're trying to avoid. So we're not saying we can't provide hospital in the home or that we won't support people, but we have to be set up properly to do that. And that unfortunately takes a little bit of time to make sure we've got the equipment, to make sure the surge workforce has come in, to do all of those things. And then I think we can support individuals, you know, if they are palliative and they want to remain and we're well set up and we're separated and we've got staff that we need and the equipment that we need, then I think we can do that.
One complaint from many families has been that communications with them has been totally absent or very sparse. One would have thought that that was something that homes should have been able to set up or to maintain. Why has that been so bad?
Oh, look, and I agree, and I think it's been really difficult for families, and I, you know, my heart goes out to them, and I'm sorry they've had that experience. I mean, I think what has happened and what we've seen with providers is that they are so stretched and they are busy trying to fill shifts and make sure they've got staff. It's not an excuse. It shouldn't fall off. But I think in the cut and thrust of what's been happening, that's where sometimes that communication hasn't been all that it could be. And it's certainly something that we work with members about. And I know that the Victorian Response Centre is also making that a priority to make sure that that doesn't that doesn't become a casualty of the stress in the system.
Do you feel the Victorian situation is now being brought under control, or do you think things are still getting worse in these places?
I don't think it's completely under control as yet, sadly, and that is a really sad thing to say. I think the Victorian Response Centre, which we all hope will start to deal with some of these practical on the ground issues, is finding its feet and is reaching out to providers and should help with the issues around when there isn't a workforce. I think that what the Premier did yesterday with, you know, making the public hospital capacity is another step, but I don't think we're there yet. And sadly, the health authorities seem to be saying that, you know, the impact on people's lives could continue for some time. Sadly, the deaths and the number of cases of people who be infected, they seem to think will rise. I can only hope and do everything that I can and support our providers to try and make sure that they're doing everything that they can and we get it under control as soon as possible.
And what do you think should be done now across the country to make sure that we don't have repeats of what we've been seeing in Victoria and what happened in some facilities in New South Wales? If we get outbreaks in other states, how do you fireproof these facilities?
Victoria is a salutary lesson, and I think, you know, what it shows, first of all, is the importance of the vigilance that is needed for us to know that older people are really vulnerable and that as restrictions ease, that people really, including staff, all of us as community members, have to do everything we can to protect older people, not go out if we're not well, not go to work if we've got a sniffle. You know, all of those things are critical, because if we can keep community transmission low, we'll also help to keep it out of aged care facilities. Providers obviously around the country and our members around the country are looking on as concerned as anybody about what's happening in Victoria, and I know are taking steps to increase the work that they're doing to remain prepared. So they'll be reviewing their plans, they'll be reviewing their PPE stockpiles, they'll be looking at staffing. And we know that many of the state governments too are looking at the one worker, one site. And we're involved in creating a support hub to enable that to happen and to make sure that workers and providers are working those issues through. At the moment, that's only available in Victoria, but I think it will very quickly become something in all of the states. We're urging the state governments in all states to work with aged care. One of the other things that we see, because aged care and healthcare, you know, are in different systems and there are interface issues, is sometimes the states are really good at working with health services and planning with health services, but aged care providers aren't always included in that. And we are certainly talking to state governments about the need for us to be in lockstep and to work as one to support the health of older Australians in our care. Obviously, we've talked already about the hospitalisation policy, and that's something that we do want to see other states follow the lead of South Australia and make it a policy that those first cases will actually be transferred to hospital to give us a chance to set up for, as you point out, hospital in the home solutions. So I think there's a lot of things that we can be doing, and we need to learn the lessons, particularly from Victoria, where the scale is something that we didn't witness in New South Wales. We must make sure that that doesn't happen in other areas around the country, and providers, state governments, the health system, the federal government, we all need to work together to that end.
You mentioned protective equipment, and we did hear in the earlier stages a lot of reassurance from the federal government that there was enough protective equipment. We did also hear some mixed messages about the whole issue of masks. Do you think there was a failure here on those fronts?
I think in the early days there were shortages of personal protective equipment. Certainly our members were trying to source it from their usual suppliers, and they couldn't necessarily get what they needed, or the price, you know, there was price gouging. So I think in the early days there certainly were issues in getting it, and I know the Commonwealth have said they now have good stockpiles, which is great to hear, and that they're looking at the logistics to make sure that where providers need to get it, they can get it quickly and without delay. So I think that situation is improving. And on the masks, I think, you know, masks, using masks in aged care generally when there isn't an outbreak is only something that's been required relatively recently. It probably reflects a broader community position that, you know, that health authorities were saying masks weren't necessary. And now, of course, we're seeing in Victoria that, you know, if I step outside my door, I need to wear a mask, and there are now fines for people not wearing them. I think we didn't do that as a country quickly enough and follow the lead of other countries who've been wearing masks for a long time. Countries that have had to deal with really infectious outbreaks before have recommended the use of masks for a long, long time. So I think we've lagged as a community, and sadly we've lagged in aged care as well, with that only becoming a requirement just ahead of them saying that everybody who leaves their house should be wearing a mask in Victoria.
But it did seem very odd, didn't it? Because it would seem common sense that if they might help, then why not, say, use them? And yet federal health officials were early on quite dismissive of masks or against masks. Was this simply because they didn't have enough and didn't want to encourage the wider use, or is this some sort of odd ideological issue in the medical community?
Well, it's an interesting question, one to which I don't really know the answer. I suppose I didn't understand it, you know, early on why they weren't being recommended. I would hope and doubt that it was because they just didn't have enough. I think perhaps as we're learning more about COVID, and I think that's something that's important, we're all learning about COVID and we're all learning a new way to live and we're all learning new ways to try and restrict its spread, that it just became, you know, that it became important that masks became used, and I think that's when the advice changed.
Just turning to the aged care system more generally, has the federal government been lagging in its regulation of this system? Have homes been under enough scrutiny, enough spot checks, for example?
So every time the regulator comes in now, it's a spot check. So there are no announced visits. There were changes made a couple of years ago, and you know, the regulation changed. So from a provider's point of view, I think the regulator does come in and looks fairly carefully. Whether the regulator always picks up if there are issues, I guess, is another question. I think the thing about aged care, though, is that one of the things we have to do, and it's why the Royal Commission is really important, is we need to be clear about what it is that aged care is. That sounds like a silly thing to say, but I think there's a clash of expectations about what aged care is. I think the community thinks that aged care is going to be more like a hospital, and, you know, they used to be called nursing homes and that's what people thought they were. But in recent times, you know, there's been a move to them being more home-like and less emphasis on clinical. So I think one of the critical things we need to do is actually to determine what is it that aged care is providing. And then I think a lot of things follow from that. it's not just the regulation. There are funding issues. There are 60% of all providers now, or of all facilities, sorry, residential care facilities, are operating at a loss. And that rises to a whopping 75% in regional Australia. So there are a real lot of, you know, there are a lot of issues that are impacting on the services that we're able to provide. But absolutely critical is we need to decide what it is that we want aged care to be. And we need to decide then as a community how we fund it so that it can deliver the quality of care that the community expects and that we as providers want to provide. And I should say too, Michelle, that we support 1.3 million people a year, roughly, and most of those live in their own homes. And I think a lot of the focus at the moment is on residential care, as it should be because of the issues that are happening there. But we also support people at home. There are more than 100,000 people waiting in their homes for a home care package that they can't get, and people waiting for lower level services and support too. So the system is in serious need of reform. And, you know, we're really pleased that the Royal Commission is looking at all of those things. It's going to be really important that we reform the system and focus it on what it is that older Australians need.
Well, to go back to your fundamental question, you say that we should decide what we want from aged care. What should we want?
Well, I think that the model, if we take residential care, the model has been much more home-like. But I think what we've seen over recent times is that older Australians don't come into residential care now until they are frailer and have more complex health conditions. So I think we have to look at the reality in residential aged care that we do have a frailer population with more complex health care, and maybe we need to either ramp up what the state government provides into people in residential aged care if they're going to continue to remain responsible for healthcare services, or we need to actually fund and staff residential aged care quite differently, acknowledging that we have people with much more complex healthcare conditions. That might be one of the things that comes out of it. But we also need to make sure that, you know, this is about people's lives, whether they're living in residential care or in their own home. It is about supporting people. We want to see one of the biggest reforms we want to see is a wellness kind of model being taken. We often are funded and supported to support people manage their deficits. And in some ways, sometimes we're making those worse. What we really want to see is and support is people to be able to be as independent as they want and to have as much agency over their own life as they want to have. So there are some really fundamental reforms. We need to come at aged care from a human rights, you know, from a human rights perspective. And, you know, it's something that we've all got an interest in, because if we're lucky, we're all going to be older people.
So what sort of changes are needed to get that wellness index up?
Yeah, I think it is about turning the model around on its head, in a sense, to do more preventative work to help keep people fit and healthy, you know, to help them keep out and active in the community, whereas now sometimes services don't go in until people you know, really can't manage without them. So I think we have to change that fundamental underpinning.
So you're saying that we need to keep people out of these facilities?
Well, not necessarily out of their facilities. I think there is going to be a need to continue to have residential care. There does come, for many people and for many families, a time where someone can't be cared for at home, but we need to make sure that they are the best they can be, and manage that balance between giving people a home-like experience but have the clinical and healthcare services that they need. And at the moment, that healthcare element is problematic in residential aged care. But if someone's living at home, we also need to make sure that we're working to keep them connected in the community, and make sure they're not lonely at home. And I think that there's a lot that we can do to make sure that we are keeping people connected. And in some ways, the experience that we've been having through COVID about how we stay connected will inform, I'm sure, changes in the future.
Do you think that the not-for-profit sector, which you're representing, is performing better and is better placed than the commercial providers?
I mean, not-for-profit providers exist, I guess, to, you know, they're invested in their local communities. They run services which, you know, to the extent that there is a surplus, and it's really important that all services make a surplus. That's how we're able to train staff and refurbish facilities and do all of those things. They are reinvesting that into the care and support of older Australians, and I think that's really important. They're very focused on the older person that they care for, and making sure that they're the best they can be. So I think they have an incredibly important role to play, and that community investment and existing only to provide services in the community is a really important contribution that not-for-profit organisations make to the community.
So do you think that the commercial providers, because they're making a profit or wanting to make a profit, often not, therefore more compromised in providing service?
I don't know if I'd say they're more compromised. I guess what I'm saying is I think that not-for-profit providers exist solely to provide community benefit services, and that's what they do.
Now, the Royal Commission's interim report was very scathing about the aged care system. Just finally, what reforms are you looking for after the final report?
I think we've touched on some of them as we've been talking. I think we need to make sure that we've got an aged care system that's the best in the world. The Royal Commission did a study recently comparing us with other international systems. Scandinavian countries are often held out to be exemplars in aged care, and they tend to do more and more home-based care. They have things called apartments for life. So as your needs increase, so does the support that's able to be provided to you at home. And they also, at that top end, where people are really having complex healthcare issues, they provide really good care in residential facilities. So I think comparing us with those countries is important. What that study actually found was that in those countries, they spend around 4% of their GDP on long-term care services. In Australia, we spend around 1% of our GDP. I think it shows, and I think there's growing acknowledgement and growing evidence that we're not investing enough in the services to make sure that we can deliver the care that the community wants and expects, and that we as providers want to deliver. So what I'm hoping to see out of the Royal Commission is that that we do need a system that's wellness-based. We need a system that supports people at home, that provides, you know, the very best in terms of healthcare needs, and that does require us to look at the interface with the health system and either make sure that the interface is working well or that we are equipped to deliver that care. So those are some of the things that need to come out of the commission. There's no doubt that we need a fundamental reform, and there's no doubt that providers are doing the very best they can now with the resourcing and the restraints around what it is that we can do. But we're all looking forward to a reformed system where we can, you know, we can give older Australians the care that we think they deserve.
Patricia Sparrow, thank you very much for sharing your insights on what is a very, very difficult issue at any time, but especially now. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast for today. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.